Good afternoon, and welcome to the Fireside Chat on Pay on Play, Pay to Play, sorry, broadcast by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society on www.sechistorical.org. My name is Lisa Fairfax, and I'm a professor of law at the George Washington University Law School, and I'm the moderator for today's program. In 1994, the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board adopted MSRB Rule G37. The rule was designed to ensure that bond business is awarded on the basis of merit by seeking to sever any connection between political contributions to issuers and the awarding of underwriting contracts to municipal securities dealers. The rule was the first of its kind to address pay-to-play in the financial industry. As MSRB Executive Director Lynette Kelly Hotchkiss has stated, the MSRB was the first regulator to prohibit pay-to-play activities in the financial services industry. And our rules have served as a model for similar federal and state prohibitions. Joining me today to discuss MSRB's role in the creation of the pay-to-play rule and its role in curbing conflicts of interest in the municipal market are David Clapp, a retired partner with Goldman Sachs and Company, and the 1994 chairman of the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. Also joining me is Ronald Stack, Managing Director, Wells Fargo, and the 2009 Chairman of the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. So welcome to both of you guys. Before we begin our program, I'd just like to say a couple of words. Today's program is one activity in a partnership between the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board and the SEC Historical Society, and it's going to preserve the significant history of municipal securities regulation. The MSRB was established by Congress to develop rules regulating securities firms and banks involved in underwriting, trading, and selling municipal securities. The MSRB is a self-regulatory organization subject to oversight by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, or the SEC. Under the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, the MSRB's rulemaking authority has been extended to regulate municipal advisors. Its investor protection rules now protect municipal entities. The SEC Historical Society, through its virtual museum and archive, shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation from the 20th century to the present. The museum and archive is free and accessible worldwide at all times. Both the museum and the society are independent of and separate from the SEC and receive no funding from the public sector. The Virtual Museum and Archive already include materials on municipal securities regulation, including the April 2005 Fireside Chat on Municipal Securities, available in programs, over 20 developments on municipal securities regulation since the 1970s in the timeline, as well as a recent interview with Frank Chin, a former chairman of the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, available in oral histories. Today's Fireside Chat will add to the information on municipal securities regulation in the museum collection. The Society thanks the MSRB for its generous sponsorship of today's programs. I would like to note, however, that it was the Society who selected me to moderate today's program. I am solely responsible for the topics and questions that will be discussed, and I have developed these questions independent of the MSRB. And with that, let's begin. First, I'll start with a very basic question, and that, David, exactly what does MSRB Rule G37 do, and to whom does it apply?
Well, the rule itself was put together to prohibit broker-dealers and banks from doing negotiated underwritings, bond business, in the municipal bond business, and some other markets as well, with a state or local government within 2 years after certain contributions to official of such an issuer are made by the dealer or any municipal finance professional in the firm or by any political action committee controlled by the dealer. It was actually put together to stop people from bribing people to give them business. The rule goes much longer than that, and there are some devils in the detail, but it prohibits the solicitation or coordination by a dealer and a professional of contributions to officials, of issuers, and covers contributions made by professionals who have a direct interest in being awarded new business from an issuer and who seek that kind of business. And it runs not just to the municipal professionals themselves, but to people to whom they report to at their firms, including and right up to the CEO, and there have been some instances involving CEOs. That's it. Anybody is allowed to make a de minimis, so-called de minimis contribution of $250 to any candidate, really basically because it was felt at the time by the board that eliminating all of the contributions that you might make could be, you could have a First Amendment problem and some other complications.
Sure. We'll talk just a second. I'm glad you raised the First Amendment issue. We'll talk just a second about that. But first, just at its basic level, what kinds of concerns motivated the adoption of G37?
Well, you know, P37 relates to the fact that for quite a period of time, in the municipal bond business, and it's true of other businesses, of course, as well. The whining and dining habit that people got into with potential clients had grown into not just whining and dining, but people asking for contributions for their candidates or asking people to buy tables at the events that were being held in honor of the candidates and et cetera. One of the main things that happened was that while this just started with whining and dining and a few little requests for money here and there, it grew into a very big deal with people asking for firms or individual municipal finance professionals or their bosses to buy tables at these events costing from $25,000 to $50,000 and on occasion more. I myself experienced someone sitting across the table from me saying that she needed $50,000 for me from a candidate who was running for office, and I said I wasn't able to do that, and she said, well, then I have to be very frank with you. You're not going to do any business with this particular client. And that got me going.
Yeah.
It wasn't the first instance. But I thought, this is blatant and it's horrible.
Wow.
It's bribery. I won't mention the names of anybody because Ron knows them.
I think I was in the meeting, David.
Uh-oh.
Not in that meeting.
Okay.
That's really what was going on. I was giving everybody a terrible, terrible feeling that our business was kind of crooked. I mean, let me just give you one little example. Let's say you have a municipal entity and it's in the South somewhere. I'm not picking on the South. It can be anywhere, actually. And let's say it's a $10 million issue. And let's say somebody asks you for a $10,000 contribution. If you agree to make that and they give you the deal, instead of making, let's say you were going to make a point, instead of making $100,000 on the $10 million deal, you'd make a $90,000. But you see, that's not so bad. 90 is not zero.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I mean, one of the things I get from your example is, I mean, we use the term pay to play, and I think some people might think of that as a kind of quid pro quo, but it sounds like it actually can extend quite much more broadly than that. So, Ron, let me ask you, when people talk about pay to play, what exactly are they referring to? Sure.
Pay-to-play was borrowed. That was a term that had lasted for a long time, basically in the construction business, and where construction companies of one kind or another who were going to be awarded business or got business on an awarded basis from some kind of municipal entity or other would pay some dough to get the business. So it didn't really initiate with us. But it seemed like a good name, and we adopted it. Go ahead, please go to Ron.
Sure. I'm sorry. I was just asking Ron to elaborate a little bit more on that, on the term pay to play, and the fact that it seems to sweep more broadly than I think what people may traditionally understand it as. So maybe if Ron could just chime in.
Okay. I would say, I'd like to begin by saying that David's too modest to say this himself, so I'll say it, is that David was the driving force behind G37. David Clapp, as chairman of the MSRB, forced this, pushed this with Chairman Leavitt, with others, with Frank Zarb, other people in the, you know, who were interested. But he was the industry leader in doing it. And for that, you know, he will go down in history in a legacy of municipal bonds of having gotten this done. Mm-hmm. Because what David was able to do was to have the foresight and insight and ability to understand that although this, what we call pay to play, which in its most gross terms, as David alluded to, is actually extortion, that in the public sector arena where we were in the municipal industry, that it was a different, we had a higher level of responsibility in not submitting to it. Mm-hmm. We were dealing with it, a market that the issuers were public sector clients. They were governments, they were hospitals, they were universities, these were 501c3s, and a lot of governments in terms of the election campaigns, obviously, the main focus. But these, and the bonds were being bought a lot, more and more, and a great deal today in this $3 trillion market, by retail customers, by mom-and-pop retail customers. And the protection of those customers and the protection of the issuers themselves in the market of municipal securities required a leader like David to say, do you know what? You know, although there is no, you know, proverbial, provable, indictable, extortion or pay to play going on here, quid pro quo, there's still something wrong. If you actually had, for example, a true quid pro quo, you would have an indictable offense. But no one had that. It was sort of like, I am the treasurer of the state of XYZ. I want you to give $50,000 to my campaign. I mean, it was sort of, there was no like, and if you don't necessarily, or if you do, maybe it wasn't explicitly said, but it was clear to us as industry recipients what was being said. And that, although there was no direct written or verbal necessarily quid pro quo, it was implied. And David had the foresight to say, we have to stop this. Mm-hmm. And he led the MSRB of the early 90s into adoption of this rule, which, as you know, is going all the way up into yesterday's New York Times, where it had the President of the United States considering an executive order to have just disclosure of corporate contributions. Yep. This has not ended. It never will end as long as there are political contributions.
I think that's exactly right. And and the one thing that your words just captures this notion of the importance of the, obviously to make sure there's nothing, kind of no direct quid pro quo, but nothing that, undermines investor confidence, undermines also the public. You get these retail customers and kind of making sure that they feel secure about the industry. That seems to be one of the concerns that this rule was trying to address. Let me just you spoke a little bit when you were mentioning David's very important role in getting this rule passed. You spoke a little bit about Chairman Leavitt, and so I just wanted to get your insights, Ron, on kind of what was his role in kind of pushing or helping to support this rule, or did he have a role?
I think I will defer to David on it, but I mean, it really, I think, began with the MSRB. It was already working there when Chairman Leavitt was sworn in as chairman in 1993, but he became a key proponent. His father had been controller of the state of New York for, I think, 12 or 16 years. I'm not sure which. Was well known. And then his son Arthur Levitt Jr. Had been at the American Stock Exchange and been in the securities world. But David, why don't you? I think that's more for you in terms of what
Arthur came into this not really late, but because he hadn't been appointed yet. But I've known Arthur many years. And what happened to him was he liked it. He latched on to it. He said, this is something I can do something about, and we ought to do something about. So, but then he went in sort of a different way. Instead of just getting behind the MSRB, what he wound up doing was putting together a group of major dealers, investment banking dealers, who became known as the Group of 17. And he had a meeting, and he had me round most of them up to have a meeting down in Washington to discuss this, and I have to tell you, these were guys that ran Wall Street firms, and they had no idea what they were doing there. Dick Fuld, you'll remember him, came up to me and said, what am I doing here? And I said, well, you know, just listen, Dick. Don't worry about it. So Arthur explained to them, and they, you know, nobody had any trouble with it. They said, okay, well, we'll do whatever you want to do. And Arthur said, well, I just want to say this because in case, for some reason or other, A, the MSRB doesn't really pass this thing, or B, they pass it and then it's found not to be constitutional, I want these 17 firms to stick to it anyway. Make a moral, or whatever you want to call it, commitment that they were going to stick with it anyway. And my own boss from Goldman Sachs, Steve Friedman, said to me afterwards, you know, can he hold all these people together and something like that? And I said, you know, I don't know. Time will tell. So, I don't want to play him down either, because he had a lot of statements he made to the press and to other people in support of this kind of thing and what we were doing, and having his name involved with it was very important.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you talk about you've got a bunch of people, obviously, behind the rule and wanting it implemented. So that raises a kind of question on the other side, which is, were there anyone who pushed back? And if so, what was the pushback on adopting a rule like this? Or maybe I'll just ask Ron that. What kind of concerns?
Well, I think that, the vast majority of the original commentators to the original draft rule did recognize a problem existed which needed to be dealt with. There was some what you might call, David mentioned devils in the detail, nuts and bolts types of concern. The MSRB went through its lengthy rulemaking process, getting comments and trying to deal with them, and the as well as the broader issues of the constitutional requirements, whether it met those. And the MSRB worked very hard to try to address the First Amendment concerns that some people had. There were always some firms that I think were opposed to it because they felt that it would in fact inhibit them from getting business, that they thought that they would put them at an unfair disadvantage in terms of maybe a larger firm, the fact that their contributions in their mind was sort of a leveling thing, and as opposed to something giving them an advantage. Mm-hmm. So there were firms who were against it, I think, but in the end, I think that basically the industry as a whole supported it as a good idea for the industry.
And there was some pushback, too, from the elected officials themselves. Hmm. First of all, they felt us getting the, you know, they'd always gotten political contributions, and a lot of them would have argued that they were not giving out business based on whether they did or didn't get one. But I'll tell you something. I addressed I was invited to address a meeting of the state treasurers from all over the country, and the meeting was being held in Utah, and the then treasurer of the state of Utah, a friend of mine, said, you know, you better watch. This is not going to go so great. And I found out what he meant. After I was introduced, half of them got up and left the room.
Wow.
Noisily, I might say.
Wow.
So there were elected politicians who took great issue with this too.
There were also concerns that there were other groups in the municipal industry, for example, attorneys, who, as much as we tried to pressure the bar associations to take a position and do a voluntary ban themselves, since the each state has, you know, regulates their attorneys, mm-hmm. there's no federal regulation of attorneys. The lawyers, all the way up to this day, are not subject to any ban on contributions. Mm-hmm. And so there was sort of a, you know, on the one hand, the underwriter, you know, could not give a contribution, but a law firm whose partner might be giving the tax opinion could actually give money. Yeah. And there was some like, well, this doesn't make sense, but there was nothing the MSRB could do about it.
Well, the good thing there is, and believe me, they're some of my best friends, but they're generally too cheap to make very big contributions.
I'm making no comment.
But
I hate to say it, but it's true. Or as one of them said, why is anybody afraid of us? We can't give anything.
But one of the things I think is important, I think, to note here, too, is that, and I think, David, you would agree, what G37 also demonstrated was the unique importance of a self-regulatory organization, an SRO, which the MSRB mm-hmm. was then and is today. Because as an SRO, the industry, and I just again say under Davis, it was able to look at itself and say, we need to fix this. And it was able to come up with a rule to fix it. It is under the aegis of the SEC. Its rules are ultimately approved by the SEC, the regulatory branch for the federal government. But it was the SRO that said, we need to clean this up ourselves. It was not going to be cleaned up by, as David said, by elected politicians who were depending upon our money to, you know, stop us from giving them money. There was nobody doing that. It required a self-regulatory organization to look at itself and say, let's clean up the industry ourselves. And I think that, you know, this was one example when people say, you know, you're an SRO, you can't regulate yourself, you're all in it for yourselves. Well, this showed that an SRO actually could do something that was for the benefit of the industry and the public, that not necessarily in the benefit of the elected officials.
That's a very good point. And I think you're exactly right. A lot of people look at SROs and think that they don't have the ability to regulate themselves. And you raise a very important point about this ability to kind of look at themselves, look at the industry practices, and based on their experience in the industry, really come up with a rule, really first understand the problem, and then come up with a rule that seeks to address it. I wonder, though, I mean, some might say, and this is for either one of you guys, some might say, look, there are a lot of potential ways that you can deal with this sort of problem. Codes of ethics, compliance procedures, a lot of stuff kind of short of a firm rule. Do you think those things are less effective than a rule? You know, why not rely on kind of something else other than a particular rule like the G37? David?
Well, there's a couple of reasons why. One thing about all that is, and this is the first thing that pops out at me, when you have a rule, a regulation, not an SRO-type regulation, but the kind of thing that I think you're talking about, you're not going to stop the bad guys. The guys who want to give them, and incidentally, to this day, you would probably have a hard time stopping the real bad guys. Mm-hmm. But I thought was that you could do all this kind of thing you wanted in terms of putting together various kinds of codes of conduct and et cetera, and everybody would pay lip service to it, and then in the end it just wouldn't work, and worse, it would probably become sort of a joke. Ron, what do you, go ahead.
I agree with you 100%, David. But I think, you know, one of the great things about having a regulation like this is that it becomes so critical and the penalty is so onerous. That is, if, and this happened to a major firm, the head of the fixed income division gives money to the governor of Massachusetts, who at the time was running for the Senate, that firm, even though the firm itself caught the contribution, reported itself, that firm was banned from doing business in the state of Massachusetts for 2 years. That is a very, very onerous penalty. And so what you have now is on Wall Street, you have a situation where this rule is taken so seriously in a municipal department, anywhere you have what we call municipal finance professionals, it is drilled into people's heads from day one. Before they're hired, they're asked whether they have given any political contributions. We have, because the SEC requirements, MSRB, we have annual compliance reviews. In that, you know, I ran a department, David ran a department. The thing you keep saying, you know, you got to understand G37, because the biggest fear in Wall Street municipal department is you're running a department and you're in a state of New York, for example, and you have a young guy or woman who lives in New Jersey who just thinks it's okay to give Governor Cuomo a $300 contribution. Right? Because, you know, or, no, I'm sorry, $250 contribution. Knowing that, well, he lives in New Jersey, can't vote for the governor, and gives $250 to Governor Cuomo running for election. Mm-hmm. That $250 could ban, say, Goldman Sachs from doing business in the state of New York for 2 years. That one little innocent act could do that. Mm-hmm. So the rule is strictly enforced internally by the firms, because it is a regulation that is a rule of the MSRB and therefore the SEC.
Yeah.
By the way, one of my both knew a fellow who made the contribution. He had no idea there was such a rule. Had he knowing what I knew about him, I'm not sure he probably wouldn't have done it. But he had no idea there was such a rule.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I think, you know, one of the things that you guys are suggesting is important about the rule is it actually has a huge deterrent impact. But also, it sounds like one of the key pieces of the rule is that it becomes a part of best practices. It creates the norm. So if you want a system of kind of voluntary compliance, the question is, to what are you complying? And the answer is, if you have a rule, then people kind of start realizing that is, you know, one of the things that they have to do in the ordinary course. So then it seeps into the culture, if you will, it
yes.
sounds like.
Yes, absolutely.
Of the,
yeah, and I think it has. I think that's exactly what's happened. And I think that actually people don't worry about it or complain or moan about it very much anymore. It's in the
yeah.
sort of, it's, people just sort of understand that's the way it is.
Yeah. It's just something you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I briefly want to talk a little bit, because we've been kind of circling around this First Amendment question, and obviously very early on in its history, the rule was challenged on First Amendment grounds, and I won't go too much in detail, but was challenged, you know, based on the notion that it infringed on the First Amendment rights of those who want to give political contributions, and essentially the appeals court upheld the rule against that challenge, and really upheld it, which is important under a strict scrutiny basis, basically saying that the rule was narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling state interest, and that interest is obviously to protect the municipal securities industry. So I think the good thing about the rule, and I'm sure you guys would probably agree, but I'll ask, is that it's been tested. That is, appeals court upheld the rule, and the Supreme Court didn't disturb that decision. So I think that's a good position to be in from a kind of First Amendment perspective, and one of the probably more obvious federal challenges to a rule such as this. I don't know if you guys have anything further to say.
I will tell you that when we were passing the rule, one of the longest discussions, I'll say, we had was how much money could we put in the de minimis part of it?
Yeah.
$250, $500, $1,000, $100. People had different ideas. $250 became... there were some other examples of 250. So that's really the one we picked. There wasn't any great philosophical thing about it. We didn't think $250 was so little that it didn't matter, and we didn't think that it was by any matter of means so much that it would you know, really affect have a great effect on what we were trying to do. So that's where the $250 came from.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's just the way that this thing really moved along in a way that We just felt our way through each little thing that happened. I know we're getting to things that subsequent MSRB actions that picked up on some of the things that this rule did not pick up, G-47 didn't pick up on. But it wasn't easy to do this. There was no clear example of exactly this.
Yeah.
One other thing I want to say about SROs, you know, the NASD, which had long been a self-regulating organization relative to securities dealers in general, had come up under tons and tons of criticism over the years for basically finding in favor of the securities dealers guys against the customer, that is to say, the client. And, you know, that was in the back of everybody's mind.
The notion that we need to do more to make sure that we're protecting the client, you mean?
Well, the fact that SROs cannot really, are seemingly not very effective. After all, look at the NASD. Now, I mean, as a guy who worked in the securities industry for 30 years, I thought the NASD did not a bad job, but the press thought it did a lousy job, and the financial press in particular.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly I think we're just talking about this notion of people attacking SROs or at least questioning their legitimacy in the face of the kind of more obvious criticism that you can't expect people to kind of regulate themselves. But I think a rule like this, exactly as Ron pinpointed, really does underscore the fact that, in fact, there are things that SRRs can do to regulate themselves. And because they have greater experience, that they may have a greater understanding of, you know, the types of rules that will work. And the type of things that are warranted. Ron, you had some.
I just like to, I'm going to turn the tables here. Okay, Lisa?
Sure.
Okay, since you teach law.
Uh-oh.
Given the Citizens United case, which where the court, this current court, on a 5-4 decision struck down a provision of the McCain-Feingold Act that prohibited corporations, both profit and not-for-profit, and unions from broadcasting election communications, this court is very strong on the First Amendment. Is very not hesitant to overturn precedent, as we've known. Would you speculate? I mean, you know, could, you know, I would not think that our rule will come up before the court, but, you know, how would this current court view something like a G-37 and maybe in another area or whatever?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a very important question, and I think a case like Citizens United raises again the specter that maybe there's a constitutional challenge that can be brought against a rule such as this, and that's always a question, right? Whenever you get to issues about restrictions on political contributions, and certainly you're exactly right. This court seems to be incredibly sensitive to that, and the court also seems to be incredibly mindful not just of individual rights, but of course organizational rights, which this rule bumps up against. Having said that, I don't think this rule. And of course, I should caveat all by saying you never can predict what the Supreme Court would do. But I think this rule is fairly safe. You know, again, you know, you have this, you know, in terms of precedent, you at least have the appeals court decision kind of upholding the rule under a strict scrutiny analysis, which is what I just said is very important, because ultimately what they're saying is that we think this rule is actually quite narrowly tailored to do what it's supposed to do, which is to protect against bribery, to protect against to protect retail investors and to protect the consumer. And I do think that what people should not take out of Citizens United is that there can be no prohibitions on political contributions. That's not what the court was saying. Instead, what they were saying is that you need to have a rule that's quite quite narrowly tailored. And I think, number one, the de minimis exception is very important. And number two, the fact that it's not an all-out ban. It's a kind of two-year, you know, designed to impact particular people, particular professionals. So I think actually David likely deserves the credit for that, that it it's a rule that kind of nicely balances the two competing interests that the court would be concerned about. So, I mean, it's my sense, you know, you always have to be concerned about the possibility of that type of challenge. But I really, I think that G37 is kind of well crafted in that way to kind of dodge that challenge.
We actually retained to help the MSRB. An individual who later became chairman of the SEC. Mm-hmm. And Lisa, to tell you the truth, his description of why he thought we were okay sounded a lot like what you were saying. And we were, you know, because he was saying if this was an out-and-out ban, you'd have a problem.
Yep.
But it's not an out-and-out ban. Now, the question is, can you craft it in such a way that it truly is not an out-and-out ban, that it's just not an out-and-out ban by some other name? And, you know, we didn't know whether it didn't. But I'll tell you, one of the happiest mornings of my life was when Kit Taylor called me up and said the Supreme Court refused to hear this.
Yeah.
I will say this, too. At the time of these G37 discussions, I was at Goldman Sachs working with David, and we had many spirited discussions about this. And at one point I said to David, I'm not sure you're right, David. I think that I still have a constitutional right to make contributions. And David said, well, Stack, you have many constitutional rights, but one of them isn't working at Goldman Sachs.
I thank Ron for all the kind things he said. Ron wasn't the only guy. I was the guy myself who said, this stinks, and I'd like to see what we can do to get away from it. But I also did, I had some real grave doubts about whether, when you start messing around with what people can do constitutionally, can you craft such a thing that gets around that? So we did do it. If I hadn't let Ron go, it wouldn't have been on constitutional grounds.
Yeah. I probably should have premised all of my remarks by saying my scholarship is in the corporate and securities area. So, you know, a con law scholar might have better, been able to, talk about, Citizens United. But, I think, you know, certainly, while, you can never say never, you know, I think you have a pretty good rule on your hands. You know, of course, a lot of things have changed since the adoption of, the rule. And the rule itself has kind of evolved over time. One of the things that changed is in 1998, you got rule G38. David, can you explain a little bit what that rule is and kind of what it was aimed at responding to?
Yeah, the whole idea of G38, let's put it this way. G38 came about because by this time we found out that people were circumventing G37 basically through the use of outside consultants, paid consultants. And we always thought that we weren't the smartest men and women in the world, that somebody would figure ways around this. But that's where G38 came from. This was, was to prevent everybody from using these consultants. And the rule was intended to deter that and to detect attempt by dealers to avoid the limitations placed on them by G37.
Mm-hmm.
And also G20, which we haven't talked about. That's an earlier rule, sort of a broader, limper rule on gifts and gratuities. So,
I'm sorry, can you talk? You were just mentioned.
What happened was in 2005. The firms had to disclose that they had hired outside consultants mm-hmm. to contact issuers for them, as well as the contributions made by such outside consultants.
Yeah.
It was, can I say it was not perfect, but it was, I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah. And then another change came in 2005, right, where there was a ban on municipal securities dealers' use of consultants put in place. Ron, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I guess basically what occurred, I think one of the maybe the major impetus, and I can say this because the firm is no longer in business, one firm hired a consultant in the state of Illinois perfectly allowable in MSRB G38, fully disclosed to the issuer, et cetera. And the state of Illinois did an $8 billion pension deal. And the consultant's fee was like 10% of the firm's profits. The firm's profits were like $8 million. So the consultant got an $800,000 fee. And there was sort of an outcry like, well, what in the world is going on here? Somebody who is just, you know, a consultant made $800,000, did nothing on the deal, didn't run a number, doesn't know anything, is not a, you know, municipal expert or anything, but somehow was hired by a particular firm and was perfectly allowable. So the MSRB just said, well, you know, maybe we should think. And they went through around the country looking at different ways of disclosing and limiting, et cetera, et cetera. How can we do this? How can we make these consultants work in terms of disclosure and contributions? You know, we already had in the books, a consultant couldn't do what you couldn't do by your own self, et cetera. But the MSRB ultimately decided that the best way to deal with political consultants was to ban them. Okay, that not that the original architecture from G38, which was quite reasonable, was that it just what became impossible to police, and that the cleanest way for the industry to deal with it is that nobody could hire a consultant to be your political consultant on a financing. You could hire an engineering firm to do an engineering study. Mm-hmm. You know, you could hire a lawyer to do some legal work for you, mm-hmm. but you couldn't hire somebody to solicit municipal business for you. And that was the end of political consultants in the municipal business.
Has there been any pushback with regard to that, or is that kind of, you know, once it was implemented, people?
I think that, you know, there has been cases where people wonder whether or not, you know, David correctly said, you know, crooks will be crooks. Yeah. And, you know, I think that we've always suspected that, you know, Harry or Sally was, you know, hired as a consultant to work on, you know, the furniture design. In fact, they were hired because of their political connections and had something with the firm getting a deal. But basically, what you have, you know, goes back to the notion of an SRO, is self-regulatory. You have the firms, the best firms, the good firms, the firms that want to do it right, saying, we don't do this anymore.
Yeah.
Okay? We just don't do it. And so if you come in and say to your, you know, somebody come into my office when I was head of public finance at Lehman Brothers and said, we could hire this guy and he could, and I said, no, we don't do that.
Yeah.
We do not do that. We do not jeopardize the franchise. We do not jeopardize the department. We do not jeopardize, and you do not jeopardize your career and my career for a deal. No deal is worth it. No deal is ever worth it.
And of course, you know, it doesn't take a huge amount of gray matter to figure out that if you hired somebody to help you work on a deal and you didn't pay, I said hired, I shouldn't have, you brought someone in to help you and you didn't pay him anything, does that mean, you know, what does that mean? Well, it may mean that he's gone out and done something else for you somewhere else. And what I'm saying is, if you really want to get clever, you can get around these things. But I think what I'm suggesting, too, is that's true. But any major thing that's going on is going to be discerned and figured out. And frankly, people are going to, people within the firm itself and with other firms are going to say, that's wrong. That's not what this is all about.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the case, you know, or at least it goes without saying that, you know, someone who is determined enough, right, will try to find a way, you know, but it sounds like, you know, what these rules are designed to do is to really, you know, make sure that the bulk of the industry is doing the right thing. And in some ways to kind of give industry professionals who want to do the right thing some support, so that they can in fact say, look, not only are we doing this, but you know, this is the reason why. And you know, exactly as Ron just alluded to, we don't want to jeopardize the entire firm over some, you know, one deal or half. And I think that's very important. And I think another reason why a rule like this is important, because it gives people, in some sense, some additional ammunition for ensuring that best practices are followed.
Arthur Levitt and I were having dinner one night, of course, many years ago, and he said, let me ask you a question. He said, if we put this rule in and then years go by, what percentage of what would you consider to be success in terms of how much we eliminate this? And I said, Arthur, if we eliminate 80-85% of everything, we'll have done very well, because that'll be where the big money was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think we've done better than that considerably.
Mm-hmm.
But that was what my thinking was at the time, just because I would never have trusted the fact that we have done such a good job that somebody couldn't figure out some way around it.
Yeah, and speaking of that, I mean, that's an interesting question. I want to talk about success in a moment, but let me ask a different question since you raised it, which is, what about those getting around it? do we have other than the out and out crooks, something like this can't go away entirely. What's your sense about why, who's that 15%? Why is this still going on? And is there something, some commonality amongst though that 15%? Or, I guess I would suggest it's likely less than that. But, to the extent that these practices continue, why do you think that's so? And is there some kind of common theme about, how they continue to arise?
Well, I mean, I actually do believe it's less than 15% myself. But what I would say, first of all, this is going to sound really funny, but believe it or not, there are new dealers, or there are people who don't know the rule exists.
Hmm.
They really don't. Now, that's probably a small group, but they are there and they're doing that. Then there's just people who say, the heck with it, and Ron touched on this much earlier. I can't get any business any other way than this,
mm-hmm.
so I'm going to do it. And I'm not going to go the direct route of making a direct contribution to the guy's campaign. I'm going to use some sort of gimmick involving lawyers or consultants or somebody.
I have heard, David, I'm sure you have too, a particular individual whose mother and father in Massachusetts decided that they were going to give money to somebody running in the state of Wisconsin. You could say that undoubtedly the particular banker in Wisconsin, gave money to his mother and father who sent the money to go. But you can't prove any of that. So, if there are ways of doing that kind of things, yeah, I guess there are. The rule does not prohibit the giving of by spouses. And I think that, some of that probably goes along. But I think for the large part, it's just not something people want to do.
Yeah.
It's just nobody wants to get anywhere near that line.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, what's happening to the extent there, something's happening, it's happening kind of indirectly, and one might ask if the rule can capture that, and one response could be, you go too far out, then you really would have a First Amendment problem, but it sounds like, for the most part, the rule has, been able to kind of root out the kind of more straightforward instances that it was aimed at.
Very honestly, the mother and father in Massachusetts, in all probability, are not going to be giving vast sums of money to the candidate in Wisconsin. So you're back to sort of looking at it and saying, well, they could do it, but they've done it. But what have they really gotten, and how much money did they really give, and et cetera. I'm not forgiving it or excusing it, but that's where it's where it comes. There are still funny parts of this rule. And you said it in your outline, Lisa, is, well, what about somebody running for president? He's currently a governor, and he wants to run for president. Well, they're subject to the rule.
Yeah. And how are they subject to the rule?
Well, because while they're running, they're still the CEO of a state who appoints all the people who award all the business.
And that's good to know, because I think people wouldn't obviously think about someone who's running for president as this kind of capturing them.
It's an odd one, because, what do you think, Ron? I mean, it's an odd one. If he gets elected president, that is, you know, then we're talking about a very strange situation. I don't think we've had one like that, but it did come up in the time at the time the rule was being drafted.
It did. It actually, David, came up in the Slack's last election because Sarah Palin was governor of the state of Alaska. She no longer is governor. So
my reaction to it was, all right, I mean, if that strange, oddball, offbeat situation happens, it happens.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can't stop everything, everywhere, every time.
Yeah. Change gears a little bit, but, you know, still talking about, you know, I think the other thing that it's important to note is that since the rules implementation, there have, of course, been a lot of changes in the financial markets. One of those changes is that dealers have become affiliated with a broad range of other entities. Are there any concerns, I'll ask you, Ron, are there any concerns that these kind of affiliated relationships raise in connection with the rule?
And affiliated in terms of what the I'm sorry, Lisa, I'm not sure exactly what you're getting.
That is this notion that dealers have kind of relationships with a bunch of other entities in the industry, and how with that to, you know, to what extent does that raise a concern or a problem or banks or.
I don't know what would happen here. I mean, remember, we're trying to stop people from doing negotiated municipal bond business. And when you get too far afield in terms of the way you're suggesting, I'm just not sure how it would work. I'll be honest with you. I don't know how it would work.
I mean, as you said, one of the changes, obviously, is that after the 2008, basically all the major firms became banks. Jefferies is the largest independent broker-dealer in the country right now. That is not something that was the case in September 14th, 2008. It is now the case. So you do have a change in kind of the organizational structure, but I think basically the rule is still working as it did before.
And it doesn't make a difference, bank, broker-dealer?
There have been issues with bank PACs and how does this all work. And it's something the board will always have to continue to deal with.
Yeah. Just recently, that is in 2010, the SEC approved a pay-to-play rule aimed at curtailing practices by investment advisors. And I think the rule required that investment advisors become compliant by early March 2011. The interesting thing about that rule is, of course, the SEC not only modeled the rule after G37, but they specifically justified adoption of the rule by pinpointing the success of G37. So I know that makes you feel good, but, you know, what's your reaction? I know, obviously, that MSRB's the investment advisors don't fall within the scope of MSRB's functions, but what's your reaction to the new rule?
Just as a quick vignette, and I won't say the individual's name, David, but you know him. When we were doing G37, I got a call from a manager, a state worker of a major pension fund, who said, "How do we do this?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "Well, this happens all the time to me. I got these people who are advisors. And what do I do?" And I said, "You can't do much. There's nothing you can do. They're not regulated. There's nothing you can do." And what this individual did was that he, in order to protect himself and also his boss, was require these intermediaries, these advisors, to when they were the pension system made an investment, that they had to write a letter to him saying if they use a consultant and if they did, how much they paid him and him or her. And he did that not because he could stop it, but just because he wanted to put it on record. And also, if it just happened to be like the cousin of his boss or something, he could go in his boss and say, "We shouldn't do this one. I mean, this really won't look good if it ever comes out. So he put it on a record. But he was at 19, and this is the early 90s, he was looking for something like this, mm-hmm. which did not really occur until this recent scandals in the state of New York and the resultant changes in advisor rules. I guess I can't speak for the MSRB or whatever. I mean, the MSRB still has to work out with FINRA and the SEC exactly how all this is regulated, and that's something that still has to be done.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the scandals in New York. Does that, do you think, suggest something about a potential concern in increased pay-to-play schemes? I know that's not, I think the scandals in New York related to kind of public pension funds. Yep. Et cetera. And I think you're exactly right. That's the reason why kind of the SEC stepped in. Do you think there's any kind of broader concern more generally about a kind of reemergence, if you will, of pay-to-play schemes?
I would be remiss if I didn't state that in general, the difficulty we always have in this, and we were very special, the difficulty you have is that people give political contributions for a reason. Mm-hmm. And in our particular, in the case, for example, pensions or whatever, their treasurers or controllers, they don't have, it isn't because they like their views on social issues or they like their views on health care. I mean, there's, these people are managing money. So there's no, they are giving for a reason. And this tends to be why people give money. That is why yesterday, the president, the executive vice president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was very vehement against the possibility that President Obama would issue an executive order that would require just the disclosure of $5,000 more contributions by businesses to campaigns. Mm-hmm. It's because they are giving money for a reason. Yeah. And in some ways, by some people's views, that's free speech, and there's nothing wrong with it. And I would say in general, so this is an issue that will always be there. We because of the nexus of our public sector, of our of municipal bonds, of the retail buyers, and of being an SRA RO, we were able, under David's work, to kind of separate ourselves out from this broader debate. Mm-hmm. But this broader debate is never going to end about political contributions, should they be limited, how and why.
At the time we were doing this, and right after we did it, I was approached by more than one person who said, but what are you going to do here? I mean, all this pension money is being given away to firms and other people by these state officials, and they're giving these state officials huge, huge contributions. And my answer was, I don't like it, but I don't regulate it.
Well, now someone else is.
I mean, but it was a good, the thing it's still very relevant today. And the thing I like the best about it, and Ron was banging away at this too, is that it now distinguishes this particular business, which has a very particular place in the American economy and in the way people think about things. It distinguishes them in a way that has proved to be very effective. And it's just the simple fact of saying, if you do it, you cannot do business there. And nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to go through that.
Yeah. Well, we're getting towards the end of the program. Let me see if either one of you guys has any closing thoughts, either about the success. Ron, you made some, I think, very powerful points about the relevancy of the rule, both to, I think, the particular industry, but also, I think, important to note about the kind of broader debate about these types of contributions. So let me just give you guys both a chance to make some closing remarks on kind of the rule's relevancy or any other thing you want to say about the rule.
Well, I would say the rule has been an unqualified success. Mm-hmm. Since its inception, I think it's been enforced well. I think it's been a success. I think it set out to do the objectives that David and the board at the time laid out before the industry. And I think it has, 110% support of the major players throughout the industry. It's been a great success. And is now, as you said, being used as a model by the SEC for other areas. David?
Ron has said such nice things about me today that it occurred to me that he was going to ask me for a job. Well, I guess he's not. And I don't have one to give him anyway. I agree with what Ron said. I mean, I think it sort of did what we thought it would do. Its failures have been more or less the ones and the kinds of things that would have that happened that we more or less predicted. And I feel very good about it. I think it was and Ron said some very nice things about me, but it wasn't just me by a darn sight. And the staff of the SEC then, who, by the way, did all the drafting, which come in for a lot of credit. And I just, it was just one of those times when the time was right and we were able to get it done.
Well, thank you so much for those comments and for your insights into pay-to-play and the role of the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board in curbing the kinds of conflicts of interest that we've been talking about. I know that today's audience, as well as museum visitors, as well as me, who access the program in the future, will benefit from the remarks you made and the insights that you provided to us. Today's Fireside Chat will be permanently preserved in audio, MP3, and edited transcript formats under programs in the Virtual Museum and Archive at www.sechistorical.org. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, let me thank the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board again for their very generous support in making today's broadcast possible. Looking ahead, the Virtual Museum and Archive will next broadcast the Supreme Court and the SEC with former SEC General Counsel David Becker and Professor Adam Pritchard of the University of Michigan Law School as presenters, with Professor Kurt Hockenstein of Winona State University as moderator. Like today's broadcast, the Supreme Court and SEC online broadcast will be free and accessible worldwide without prior registration. Unlike today, it will be a live video broadcast. Please plan to join us on www.sechistorical.org on June 2nd at 12 noon Eastern Time. Thank you again for being with us today.